You're listening to EU Watchdog Radio.
Welcome to this year's first autumnal episode of EU Watchdog Radio. My name's Lucy Hall and I'm the new press officer at Corporate Europe Observatory, aka CEO. In this episode, I'm going to be interviewing my brilliant colleague Vicky Can, who is a campaigner and researcher at CEO. In particular, I'm going to be asking her about the relaunch of a unique website she helped to create called LobbyFacts. LobbyFacts is an essential tool for anybody who wants to get to grips with corporate lobbying in the EU. So, without further ado, let's chat to Vicky. Thanks for being here, Vicky. Can I just start with a really simple question, which is, what is LobbyFacts? Can you tell us what LobbyFacts is?
Yeah, lobbyfacts.eu is the website that ourselves, Corporate Europe Observatory, and the German lobby watchdog, Lobby Control, set up some years back and have recently relaunched. And we take the data from the EU Lobby Transparency Register and we scrape it and we present it in a website which enables a lot of searching, ranking the data. We have an archive that goes back many years of lobby data. And it is basically a more user-friendly way of investigating lobbying in the EU institutions.
Okay, so just for listeners who might not know lots about lobbying in the EU, what's an example of the data that can be found in the EU Transparency Register? So,
well, first thing to say about the Lobby Transparency Register is that if you are lobbying in Brussels, you should be part of it. But there are ways around it. So it is not a full picture of all lobbying that happens in the lobby in Brussels. But if you look at the EU lobby register, you will be able to find a list of files that lobby organisation works on. And it could be a company, it could be a trade association, it could be a think tank, or an NGO. So we will see the files that they work on. We will see a list of people who have access passes to the European Parliament. So we will see a list of lobbyist names if they have passes. We will see a list of data from the Commission about meetings that particular lobby organisation has had with the highest levels of the Commission. For some, but not all organisations, we will see a declaration of how much they say they spend on lobbying every year. And that is, in my mind, that is the most interesting part of the data often. And sometimes it will be a very small sum. But when we're talking about fossil fuel companies or big tech, Google, Facebook, Exxon, Shell, we're talking about millions of euros a year. The reason why I said some and not all organisations is that there is now a new rule in the official EU lobby register, which says, and it's a bit bizarre, but that non-commercial organisations, which in theory are NGOs like us, right, and perhaps think tanks, academics, yeah, they are no longer required to provide a lobby budget. Right. But because LobbyFacts has been collecting lobby data back to 2012, we have an archive of all lobby registrations dating back then. So we have now historical information about everybody's lobby spend. But today, unfortunately, businesses and others do have to give a lobby budget spend, but NGOs, unfortunately, do not. So the data is, the reporting requirements are different now according to different organisations in the register.
And so just to sort of go back to
LobbyFacts as its as a website. Why did what was the motivation to set up LobbyFacts, and how? I mean, you've mentioned it's more user friendly. Is that quite a radical difference to the EU Transparency Register, right?
Yes, it is, because if you look at the EU Register, there are very minimal search functions. You can type in the name of an organisation and see if they are registered, but it's quite hard to search for the biggest declaring organisation or for particular kinds of organisations. Mm. And crucially, the lobby register, the official one, only has information relating to today.
Okay.
To the current registrations that are live today. And so that's why I say that the added value of LobbyFacts is this archive. Why did we set it up? Well, it came out of an inspiration and a frustration, I suppose. The inspiration is looking at what they do in the US, where there is an excellent website called Open Secrets, and that pulls together lobbying information from all sorts of different sources. There is a register in DC, in Washington.
Yeah.
But there is also information available about which senator, which congressman has been funded by which interest group. And all that information is pulled together into Open Secrets. And it's such a great repository of information about lobbying in the US that we wanted to try and replicate that, even though the base information at the EU level is much less than that. So that's the inspiration. But there's also the, as I say, the frustration about the limited value and functionality of the register itself. But if you take that data, you can organize it and sort it in a different way. You can allow rankings
so this is on LobbyFacts.
On LobbyFacts, yeah, yes. Right. And you can find who is the biggest lobbyist in Brussels.
And you can't do that.
No.
Wow. Okay.
No.
So what are some examples? So you've mentioned the historical function of LobbyFacts and looking back. So with the EU Transparency Register, does it all just clear after every year and you just have the... What's the time span of data in the register, in the EU Transparency Register versus LobbyFacts?
Well, every registrant in the official register must have a update their registration every year. And ideally, organisations would do it more often, but as a minimum, they have to do it every year. But with financial information, that's not really in real time, because they will declare it for the previous financial year. So when you look at the lobby register, and indeed LobbyFacts, you are at best looking probably at a snapshot that relates to what they were up to in the previous year. So that is a limitation of both LobbyFacts and the lobby register. But LobbyFacts is only as good as the lobby register data that is there. And we have many ideas for improving how the EU lobby register could be improved, that would really improve the transparency and allow more scrutiny of lobbying. So that's the timescale. But it's a source of frustration that the register is not more, doesn't require more of registrants in terms of more regular updates and deeper and better information than it currently does.
And how reliable is the data that LobbyFacts has? I mean, I guess it's perhaps you've answered that in that it's as reliable as the EU Transparency Register.
Yeah, the reliability is tricky, because the information is largely self-declared. And certainly at the beginning, when the register was first set up in 2008, and there have been several iterations of the register since, but I think there was very much a temptation by some of the bigger names in lobbying, the big corporate names, to appear to be much smaller than they really were. So they were declaring really ridiculously small sums in the past. I think that has got better over time. I think probably most declarations are more realistic now. But the fact that the data is self-declared is an issue, because it's the there are not huge sanctions for misreporting. You can get away with misreporting, and you know, when we do our rankings on Lobby Facts, we can clearly see that there is some dodgy data there. Mm. We were looking at this last week when we launched the revamped Lobby Facts, and there are at the last check, there were 27 organisations at the top of the register who declare 10 million plus annual lobby spend. So that's a significant sum of money on lobbying. But actually, when you look at what else those organisations declare, it seems pretty obvious that actually none of them come anywhere near declaring 10 million. Maybe they're giving us their organisational budget instead. Mm. Maybe they've got fat fingers and they've added on too many zeros. Something like that has happened. But, you know, these are names. They're not household names. They don't have a presence in Brussels. They don't have many lobbyists. I mean, how you would spend 10 million when you declare less than one full-time lobbyist, you know, you just physically cannot get 10 million out of the door, really.
Yeah.
So there are some mistakes, and that is the problem with the reliability of the data, that the register is not legally binding.
Right.
It's incentivized to join, but it's not legally binding. So the data, as I say, is largely self-declared. The sanctions aren't that strong. So there can be dodgy data sitting in the register for a really long time. But Lobby Facts and its ability to filter out certain data, to sort and to rank the data, can really help you to spot this dodgy data because of the way that we present it. And, you know, so we would say that a top 10 list of the really big lobbyists in reality actually looks quite different from the one that you get just from a very basic look at the data. But that's what Lobby Facts can help you to do. It gives you a more sophisticated take on what is being declared.
It seems crazy to me that there are no, that the register isn't legally binding. Do you know, I mean, yeah, but how do they get away with that? It seems obvious that you should have to declare lobbying and that should be a law.
Yes, I agree. And this has been a fight at the EU institutional level for years, well over a decade. The European Parliament, which is also party to the register, has been demanding a legally binding register. But the Commission's view, and the European Commission is also part of the register, has always had a very strict interpretation that under the EU treaties, it's actually not possible to have a legally binding register. I mean, we disagree, but it gets into the of technicalities of the treaty. So to overcome this, over the years, they have tried, the institutions have tried another way of trying to drive up registrations. Because when people know it's not legally binding, there's actually not that much of an incentive to sign up. So over time, they've incentivized lobby organizations to sign up. So now you cannot get a European Parliament access pass unless you're in the register. That doesn't prevent you from, if you really don't want to be a part of the register, you can still
get
away with lobbying MEPs. You can meet them outside.
100%,
you can meet them in their home country. You can, you know, still get into the parliament anyway.
Sure, they can sign you in. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So so that's not foolproof, but it is a way of trying to incentivize the sign-ups. And for the Commission, they have particularly said that if you want to meet a commissioner a member of their cabinet, their teams, or if you want to meet a director general, you have to be in the lobby register. And again, you know, there are ways around that. Arguably, if you're a lobbyist, you actually get much more traction or much more influence if you speak to lower level policy officers to whom this rule doesn't apply. Right. Arguably, if you can find the person who's writing the proposal that you are interested in and speak to them, there's no need to speak to a commissioner. So there are ways around these, but over time they have tried to incentivize the sign-ups, and you can see in how the number of registrants has grown over time that actually that has worked to a degree, and now the register is much, much bigger than it was. And over time, the secretariat of the register, they have also improved the number of checks that they make on the data. There is less dodgy data than there was. That is clear. But it is still a bone of contention, I think, that it is not legally binding. And until that happens, I think there will always be some lobbying that escapes the scrutiny of the register.
Yeah.
And that's just a simple fact. Yeah.
And so Lobby Facts is part of a project that CEO and other NGOs are sort of doing, which is creating greater transparency in lobbying. And I just wondered if you could just say a bit about how transparency affects lobbying in the EU.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Of course, when you have transparency, it's an essential prerequisite, I would say, to having better decision making, to have transparency. It's essential that we know.
When you say decision making, sorry to interrupt, on what level do you mean? You mean EU?
At the EU level, yes. If we want better decision making, if we want public interest decision making, we have to have transparency.
Yeah.
We need to know who is lobbying to whom. We need to know as much as possible about what they're demanding. We need to know, and transparency goes along with a much greater set of rules around ethics, around conflicts of interest, around the revolving door. It all should be part of a bigger package of measures that are all about trying to make sure that public interest decision making occurs. But transparency is not enough. Transparency is the first step, but it is not enough. And increasingly, we see that that there have been some perhaps unexpected consequences, if you like, of transparency, and perhaps some can I even say sort of negative ones or perhaps unforeseen ones, in that you know, originally lobby consultancy firms and big corporations, I think they didn't like the idea of transparency, and they fought the idea of a lobby register, you know, and it was going to be red tape and it would hinder them and things like that. But now it's in place, and over time they have now come to realize that actually they can argue that we can do anything as long as we do it transparently. Mm. So it doesn't matter how many meetings we get, as long as they're all transparent. And you know, everything's fine. We're in the lobby register. So it has, I think the unforeseen consequence of more transparency has mean that it has given some lobbyists, particularly the corporate sector, a sort of undeserved air of legitimacy, if you like. Anything is fine as long as it's as long as it's declared in the transparency register. And that's why, as Corporate Europe Observatory, we have always emphasised that transparency isn't enough. If you're interested in tackling corporate influence, if you're interested in tackling corporate capture, transparency is an essential prerequisite, but it's not enough. it's not like the cornerstone,
yeah.
but it's not the, it's a means to an end and not an end yeah. itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we need much more in terms of ethics rules. And increasingly, we are talking about firewall approaches, particularly for the most toxic industries. So learning from the example of...
Can you quickly explain, just in case people don't know, what you mean by firewall approaches?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So... this very much comes out of the tobacco industry, where, you know, there have been decades and decades of misinformation from the tobacco industry and lobbying against public health control measures against tobacco. And then the World Health Organization has a treaty now in place around tobacco control. And one of the elements in there is about lobbying and how public decision making on health should be protected from the influence of tobacco. There is nothing that the tobacco industry can contribute to public health legislation on a public health legislation, nothing, and they should not be allowed to get anywhere near it. And that is now a recognized principle and should be being applied by governments and institutions around the world. And it comes from some decades of really hard learning of how of when tobacco was around the table, and that's what we call the firewall approach. There are some issues that are so important that they need to be protected from conflicts of interest, and public interest decision making needs to be really protected. So we learn from tobacco, and we could, today we would absolutely apply the same principles to, for example, the fossil fuel industry. Just at the moment when we're in a climate crisis, we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground, and we should not have lobbying behind closed doors by the fossil fuel industry when we are dealing with energy transition and responding to a climate crisis. I mean, I think there are many other areas where we can apply a firewall approach. For me, another one is the tax avoidance industry. We looked at the big four accountancy and tax firms, so that's PricewaterhouseCoopers and KPMG.
So when you say the tax avoidance industry, you mean companies that help individuals, or
so the big four, for example, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young, Deloitte, and KPMG. They have a dual role with many governments, including at the EU level as well, where on the one hand, they are seen as being sort of neutral advisors in the area of tax avoidance. They have in the past sat on expert groups that have advised the Commission when they've been coming up with anti-tax avoidance rules. They have been given paid consultancy advice and research on anti-tax avoidance, but on the other hand, have a huge business in actually offering tax avoidance advice to clients, corporates, and high net worth individuals. And that is a conflict of interest. And so you cannot have those who support tax avoidance acting as neutral advisors on tax avoidance policy making.
Wow.
So another example of where...
When you put it like that, that is crazy, isn't it?
Exactly. So it's another example of how we can have a firewall approach. And there will be others as well. But for us, this is really, you know, transparency is not enough. It can tell us a lot, and it can really help, particularly with our storytelling around what is actually happening in the Brussels bubble. But it's not enough if we are going to resolve the issue of corporate influence. And for that, we need to protect public interest decision making. And that's where solutions like a firewall approach can really come in.
Great. And I'm just going to ask you one more question, Vicky. And before you answer it, can you just remind our listeners of the Lobby Facts website as well, just in case they want to check it out. I guess I just kind of wanted to end with a sort of looking ahead question, which is,
How do you think, how should lobby transparency be expanded at EU level? What does that look like? What does that entail?
Yes, I mean, there is
quickly, Lobby Facts website.
Lobbyfacts.eu.
Got it. Right.
Okay. Not too tricky. No. Lobbyfacts.eu. So, but we have a long list of measures that we would like to improve specifically on the register itself. So we've talked about the need to make it legally binding. We've talked about the need for more checks on the data. We've talked about this strange new development in the register where now NGOs no longer have to provide a lobby budget. So we need to equalise the information that is being given so that we can have comparisons. We know that corporate lobbying massively outspends and outpowers NGO lobbying, but it'll be harder and harder to prove that if this silly rule stays in place that NGOs no longer are required to give a lobby budget. So there's all sorts of things that we would like to see improved in the register itself. Mm. And that will, all of those will help Lobby Facts in turn to become a better tool, an even better tool for journalists and citizens and activists. But there's it's not just about lobby transparency via the register. There's the other side of things, which is proactive transparency. And the Commission in 2014 made a very interesting step in that they started to proactively publish the list of meetings that their high level has. So again, it's commissioners, cabinet members and directors general. But you know, that is really the tip of the iceberg. There are 30,000 plus officials in the lobby register. In the commission, for example. Yeah. But maybe 300 or 400 are covered by that transparency rule. And we know that there is a lot of lobbying at those lower levels. And that can sometimes be got through access to documents, but not always. It's a bit patchy. So it would be brilliant to see the proactive transparency really it increased and developed into other areas of the commission. We know, for example, when you're looking at the finance sector, that I mean, in the past we've looked at figures which is something like 90% of all lobby meetings in the finance department are with industry and not with public interest groups. But it would be really good to have that information proactively provided, because once again, when information is put in the public domain, you can then do something about it. We can see then the problem of privileged access. We can see the problem of corporate capture. And then it helps the campaign and the momentum to really tackle it. But as I said, at the end of the day, it's not just about transparency. It is about everything that goes with it around ethics rules, conflicts of interest, the revolving door, and like I say, about firewall approaches and really getting to grips with corporate influence at the EU level, which, as you know, is CEO's bread and butter.
Yeah, and I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you very much, Vicky.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of this podcast. A special thanks to our guest, Vicky, for sharing her knowledge and her passion with us. And also to colleagues at Lobby Control, who we worked in collaboration with to create Lobby Facts. Also, a big thanks to colleague Mark Barona, who edits this podcast. CEO is a small independent organisation and we don't receive any funding from EU institutions, so your support is very valuable to us. Thank you for listening, and if you've enjoyed this podcast, please do share it with friends, family, colleagues. Thank you.